Welcome to another hour with ChiroAudio.com. My name is Dr. Kyle Hagel, and today I'll be joined by Katie Folkin. Our goal at ChiroAudio.com is to provide continuing education where you want and when you want. All right, so here we go. All right, so the next topic we're going to discuss in this hour is going to be thoracic outlet syndrome.
All right, let's do it.
So we'll start with some anatomy and then just kind of dive in from there. So traditionally, when you talk about the thoracic outlet, the kind of most traditional way to think about that is the space between the first rib and the clavicle.
Yep.
But if you really get into a little bit more detail about it, the thoracic outlet is really, that's one of three spaces. And so the first space is essentially between the middle and anterior scalenes as those nerves pass through. And then obviously the first rib and the clavicle, that would be space number two. And then space number three would be between the pec minor and the ribs. So there's a whole neurovascular bundle that passes through these three structures. And so that's the subclavian artery, the subclavian vein, and then nerves of the brachial plexus that pass through there. And so the types of thoracic outlet syndrome are separated into what structure is compressed. Is it the artery, the vein, or the nerve? So, and a lot of times if you ever choose to read studies about this, you will see it written TOS for thoracic outlet syndrome, but it'll have a small, like an A, a V, or an N in front of it, standing for arterial, venous, or neurologic thoracic outlet syndrome. And, you know, the interesting thing is that 95% of thoracic outlet syndrome is what they call neurogenic. So it's the nerve that's compressed. And then there's the venous portion, so the subclavian vein that would have some compression in it. And less than 1% of these are arterial, where the subclavian artery is compressed. But if you kind of, and we'll talk about this, how it's evaluated, a lot of the examination techniques, whether it's in the office or imaging, is sort of focused on arterial, even though it's less than 1%.
But I feel like that's what we learned is more the arterial portion.
Yep. And from an imaging perspective, and we'll dive into this, but from an imaging perspective, that's really the only thing that can be found. But in the broad grand scheme of things, it's not identifiable via imaging and really not very well with a provocative examination finding, sort of as it's traditionally taught. And, you know, this leads to a difficulty for a lot of people where they've got symptoms, and this is kind of the chiropractic world. This is where we live. We live in the land of, you know, being able to sort of know the structure, know the function, understand symptoms, and be able to provide a treatment. We don't necessarily need an MRI or an X-ray to show us what's wrong because we understand the underlying physiology and how nerves should function. And so if anybody's going to understand thoracic outlet syndrome, I think it's us.
Yeah, I agree.
And so the thing about the concern with long-term vascular compression, so most of it's neurogenic and but when it is present affecting vascular tissue, it is significant because of the things that can happen as a result of that. So if there's chronic stress or strain on the subclavian vein, it can lead to something called effort thrombosis, which is basically a blood clot forms because of the stress and strain that's put on that vessel. Obviously, you know, a blood clot can break off and travel to other places and cause problems. So It's of concern. And when the artery is affected, it can lead to aneurysm. Now, We had this discussion. You probably don't even know what's coming here, Katie, but we had this discussion 18 months ago, 2 years ago, when a friend of yours, we wouldn't think of this as thoracic outlet syndrome, but do you remember when a friend of yours had an aneurysm in the subclavian artery?
What? I do, yes.
Do you remember why that person had an aneurysm?
If I remember correctly, it's because they actually had hardware affecting it. Like they had gotten hardware put in. I think it was a shoulder. Mm-hmm. And the screw was actually putting pressure on the artery.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so even though it was a surgical hardware situation, technically, so this person had a grade 3 AC joint separation, which mm-hmm. means the ligaments between the acromion and the coracoid on the shoulder are completely disrupted. They're totally torn. Grade 3 tear, severe tear,
however you want to say it.
Naming system you want to say it. It was a complete tear with a clavicle fracture, and oftentimes those things can occur together. And when that happens, usually surgery is needed to repair the clavicle. And so one of the screws went through the clavicle either too far or at the wrong angle. I don't know what the deal was, but technically you wouldn't necessarily think of that on the surface of it, but that is a thoracic outlet syndrome.
I would never have characterized it as such, but that's super interesting. You're right.
Mm-hmm. So this gentleman, who I'm going to say is probably mid-40s at the time.
Correct.
Had shoulder pain. It wasn't going away. I don't even know if he did treatment.
I don't think he did treatment. Sure, he did, like, this is a friend in like a different world. This is not like a patient friend or anything. They live in a different area of the state.
Yeah. We didn't have anything to do with the treatment. It was just... Mm-mm.
This is just happens to.
Happens to have... Yeah. As far as I know, he didn't really have any treatment, and just the pain that he was having, I don't even really know the pain pattern, but I do know that they did end up finding an aneurysm that then needed to be surgically repaired.
Mm-hmm. No, but he actually, I don't know if you remember this part, but he actually was like slurring words and having a headache.
I did not know that.
Yeah. He had like a really bad headache that wouldn't go away. He was having problems focusing on things, and it was just the tiniest bit slurred of like just vocabulary in general. And his wife was like, you need to go in. You absolutely need to go in. And he wasn't going to, but then he did.
Got it. I did not know the full story. I thought it was a little bit. So in hindsight, though, then he said, yeah, I've had shoulder pain for years. Mm-hmm. But he just thought it had to do with the hardware and the injury. And...
Well, when he got to the hospital, they did full imaging because they thought he was having a stroke. He had all the symptoms of a stroke.
Got it.
Yeah, and that's how they found it.
So, technically, a thoracic outlet syndrome, which...
That's wild. Mm-hmm. You're right.
So, typically...
Again, I wouldn't have thought about that, but yeah.
What you think of, like, where it's at, and again, it was hardware. It wasn't a scalene muscle. It wasn't, some type of first rib anomaly. And that's the other interesting thing about... Again, we're going to talk about the minority for a second, but the less than 1%, these arterial... thoracic outlet syndromes, 95% plus, the vast majority of them, and some studies actually say 100%, have some type of first rib anomaly, either a cervical rib or something that we'll talk about more, which is called the SERBS anomaly, SRB. It's named for, the person who described it initially.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that's fascinating.
So in most cases, and lots of people tell you, in every single case, arterial, where the arteries affected thoracic outlet syndrome, there will be a first rib anomaly.
Hmm.
And this is how rare the arterial aspect of this is. There was a clinic that published a study of 18 years of their practice, and they have surgical practice, 2,500 thoracic outlet syndrome surgeries. And of the 2,500, 11 were for arterial thoracic outlet syndrome.
Really? It's that rare?
Mm-hmm. Huh. But again, imaging and examination, which we're going to talk about here, is really all geared toward vascular. So a common test that we, one of the first orthopedic tests we learn, which because it's pretty simple, is ADSENS, where you have the patient seated, their hands are in their lap, their seated knees and ankles are at 90 degrees. They're sitting up straight. You palpate the radial pulse, and you have them take a deep breath in and feel for a difference in the pulse. The idea there being, and ADSEN first, this was 1927, little history for you, that ADSEN described this. He thought, so at that time, before it was sort of fully classified as thoracic outlet syndrome, it was called scalene anticus syndrome, anterior scalene syndrome. And his view on this was that it was an arterial problem caused by the scalenes. And with inspiration, they would cause compression. Basically, when you take a deep inspiration, the scalene muscles participate as accessory muscles of breathing. They contract and raise the first rib. And technically, even if you're thinking about that, if you raise the first rib against the clavicle, now you're not only testing theoretically the scalenes, but also the costo, the costoclavicular space between the first rib and the clavicle. And he, so then years later, then writes WRIGHT. This is another one that we learn kind of along with Adson's. This other physician, Wright, said, well, you can palpate that pulse and you can have the pulse disappear on palpation if you have them turn either towards the side or away from the affected side. So with turning, again, theoretically, this is, still sort of centered around the idea of the anterior scalenes. And so with turning away or towards it, then you could cause a change in the pulse. Again, it's still all focused on the arterial side of things, which again is the vast minority of the situation. And then so when we get back to the idea of imaging for this, if we say 95% of this 95% of this is neurogenic, then hey, maybe something like a nerve conduction study or an EMG, you know, those two things are commonly done together. Maybe that could identify this. It doesn't. It's not. It's not reliable. It's not effective. How about MRI? It's not.
So what do you do?
X-ray, not definitive. CT scan, not definitive. and so that's a great question. So in researching this, I actually discovered, and we've got a bigger, longer patient case study to talk about here. And in researching, working with her and researching a little bit of background story on thoracic outlet for this, I actually came up with across a great test that really should be the one that I think, after using it now and just seeing it and understanding the background and the physiology and just common sense, says this is a great test. We should use this.
Are you going to tell us about it now or not until we get to the patient?
I'm going to tell you about it now.
Okay. I didn't know if there was going to be.
I'm just building suspense and then.
Because I'm all interested now. Like, okay, tell me about the test. I didn't know if you were.
All right.
Keeping it away.
Here it is. This test is called the upper limb tension test of ELTT. ULTT, upper limb tension test.
Okay.
ELTT is ELVEY.
Okay. Tell me about what this test
is. I had not heard of this. We all know the straight leg raise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's basically the same principle as that. It's a nerve tension test. So what you do is you have the patient either seated or standing. And you have them stand up with their arms, their shoulders are abducted at 90 degrees, straight out. Their fingers are straight. Their palm is down. So they're standing out like they're a big letter T. And at this point.
Just so all the people listening know that I'm currently doing this because I want to see. So continue.
So let's pretend that Katie has signs of thoracic outlet syndrome on her right hand. Her right upper extremity. Now, we didn't discuss signs and symptoms of thoracic outlet syndrome, but nerve compression. So it could be numbness, tingling, weakness. And this could be in the hand or wrist. It could be in the arm. It could be like a fatigue or a deep burning pain with use. And so Katie has put her arm down. Katie needs to put it up because we are going to do the upper limb tension test of ELTT.
Sorry, you got a little long-winded there.
I did. This is not a fatigue and endurance test, but Katie was doing it. So you put your arm out, and for some people that have more severe symptoms, even with just holding their arm straight out like a big letter T, they will have symptoms just simply with that. The next step of it is to dorsiflex the wrist. So bring the wrist into extension as far as it comfortably goes. And you're doing this with both arms at the same time. The entire test is done with both arms at the same time.
Okay.
And so if we think about it, what we're doing is we're creating more tension on the nerves as they pass through all of the entire thoracic outlet. And so similar to like a straight leg raise. You bring the leg up, and then if there's symptoms, then doing Braggers would be to dorsiflex the ankle. You're increasing the tension on the sciatic nerve by stretching it. And so there, with extending your wrist, you are putting more tension there. So some people will get reproduction of symptoms with that. And the third phase, or the third sort of step in this upper limb tension test, is to laterally flex your neck away from the side of testing. Now, theoretically, in a perfect world, you could have the person laterally flex their neck away from the side. So if Katie's symptomatic on her right side, she would left laterally flex her neck.
Mm-hmm.
And her symptoms would get worse because we are stretching the nerve roots out of the neck. Again, the shoulder is still at 90 degrees. The wrist is still extended. And theoretically, in a perfect world of this test, proving out thoracic outlet syndrome, the symptoms would return with lateral flexion away. And then if you laterally flex towards, the symptoms would improve because then you're reducing the strain on the nerve roots.
And that makes sense. And just spoiler alert, my test was not positive.
Okay.
Continue.
Good. Checked one off the list. But very simple. I mean, it takes a longer to describe, just like when you learn any new test going through it. But applying it, I mean, you could do this while you're just seated and taking a history before you ever move into examination. Or, patients bring up new problems all the time. You might have seen a person for 2 years and all of a sudden they have a new complaint. Well, you could easily do this test in about 10 seconds.
Right. I mean, that's such a quick, easy test to do. It takes longer to do a straight leg raise because you actually have to lay somebody down on a table. This one is
exactly
even more simple.
Exactly. And then take the weight of their leg and. So I really like the common sense and application of this, especially since, again, most of these, 95% of thoracic outlet syndrome is neurogenic and not arterial.
Right.
And that brings us to a patient that I saw that, again,
Ooh, is this our case
thing.
Study now?
Yeah, we're going to talk about a patient. This is our case study for the day. Christy is her name. Now, Christy comes in with moderate to severe neck pain. It was much more on the left. She also had pain in her left upper arm. She had tingling in the hand and just kind of a deep, really achy fatigue in her arm. And it wasn't necessarily like when she used her arm it would fatigue. It was just sort of there. And she felt a little bit better when she kind of cradled her elbow and held it up. Mm-hmm. And a little bit worse when the weight of it hung down.
Okay.
So she works, let's see, she's 51 or 52 at the time. She works in medical assembly. So she does a variety of things, but typically she's either sitting at a workstation with a microscope looking down, or sometimes she's standing but very repetitive, very small parts. And so I'm looking at things thinking, okay, postural, her shoulders are internally rotated a little bit. She doesn't have a super severe kyphosis. She has a little bit of anterior head carriage, but nothing too crazy. But when I palpate her neck muscles, she has a ton of just chronic, not a lot of swelling, but just ton of chronic muscle spasm and just scar tissue. Things are very, very hard. Kind of that long-term chronic feel that muscles that have been tight for a long time get. Upper traps, scalenes are very tight. Right side, I go over the left side, and there is a big hard lump just on the anterior side of the upper trap. The first thing I think of is that as a cervical rib.
Okay.
Because it wasn't.
Because that's the type of lump it feels like. Yeah, We're not talking about a tumor or something like that.
I wasn't worried about it being a tumor. It was clearly bony. It wasn't irregular shape. It wasn't, it felt like a cervical rib.
Okay.
So I told her, I think you have a cervical rib. Let's get an x-ray. And I think this could be explaining your the
pain
symptoms
and
you're having.
Symptoms.
And the rest of the exam, before we talk about the x-ray, she, so Tenel, so tapping over the median nerve, over the ulnar nerve as it passed through the elbow, negative, so prayer sign, reverse prayer, so extension of the wrists, flexion of the wrists, all negative, so no traditional orthopedics are positive for carpal tunnel. She has decreased sensation all on the left, C5 through T1, all dermatomes are decreased on the left, reflexes are normal. She has about 4 to 5 weakness in the triceps, so C7. And range of motion-wise in her neck, I mean, it was flexion extension she could do, but she was pretty limited in rotation and lateral flexion, especially going to the left for both of those. So we get x-rays, and she has a Serb's anomaly. Now, a Serb's anomaly is typically it affects the first rib, and sometimes it can affect both of the first ribs. And it's typically just the first rib. So if we think about the first rib, I like to think of the first rib as like a, take a letter C and maybe 3/4 of that. So mm-hmm. not the full length of it, but it's kind of that shape. And it wraps around from T1 posteriorly and then wraps around and attaches to the manubrium, the upper portion of the sternum. And Christie's rib is more like a popsicle stick.
The first rib.
So only it's like 3/4 of a popsicle stick. So it's not quite that long.
But it's straight.
It goes straight down from T1 at an angle and actually attaches into the second rib.
Interesting.
And not only does it go straight down, but there's also a pseudoarthrosis. There is a joint between rib number 1 and rib number 2.
Because where it's attaching into rib 2?
Where it attaches, yep. There is apparently, seemingly, a little bit of cartilage. Probably not a full joint capsule, but a little bit of cartilage actually where it attaches. And so the bump or lump that I was feeling wasn't necessarily, it wasn't a cervical rib. It was a hard spot in an unexpected spot, right? Because I was feeling like mid-shaft of this rib that shouldn't be there.
Ooh, that's fascinating.
Instead of being this 3/4 C, orientated horizontally, essentially, right? Parallel to the floor, very roughly. It was actually more like at a 45-degree angle down, roughly, from T1 into T2. And it wasn't necessarily, so it was like, it was slightly angled posteriorly, but also anteriorly. Because of its length, it intersected with the second rib, not just straight down, but a little bit further laterally along that second rib on the left. And so, typically with the Serb's anomaly, you can have this pseudoarthrosis, this joint between the first and second rib. But one of the hallmark signs is that there is an altered interspace, essentially, between the first and second rib.
Okay.
And so when we look at this, you can, and so views to see this, you know, you could see this on an x-ray in this patient, but sometimes you'll also see them on a chest view, or you can take rib views too, but you'll see that that altered interspace.
Interesting. Okay. Continue.
And so we treat her. So chiropractic adjustments. Oh, the other thing on x-ray that is, I think, you know, important to note here is she has maybe mild degeneration all along the right side, maybe the right facet joints. You probably wouldn't even call it out that much, but on the left, there's severe facet joint arthritis pretty much every level all the way down. But think about it, that first rib blocks her normal movement because it runs into rib number 2. So she doesn't have the same rotation and lateral flexion. Flexion probably isn't affected so much in extension. She could do it fairly well in the exam. So, but definitely there is aberrant motion. There's abnormal wear and tear on these facet joints. And, you know, she has as much degeneration on this x-ray as you could see in sort of the average 80-year-old or more. And so when you see those biomechanical stress and strains and the decades, what that causes, I just thought it was really interesting because it was so one-sided. And in anybody else without an anomaly like that, you would have some type of explanation for it, some type of injury or something like that. And I don't know that I've ever seen it so extremely one-sided without something else, you know, scoliosis or something like that.
Right.
And so we do some treatment. So chiropractic adjustments, I'm doing standard manual chiropractic adjustments, understanding and knowing that I'm not going to break up all of the restriction on the left side because it's a first rib.
Right.
Right.
Hopefully you're not going to break that.
And doing more, not just, you know, a little bit more rotation in my adjustments and my thrust as opposed to lateral flexion, just thinking about where that rib is and what movement that we reasonably could get back. And she gets some improvement. We're doing some stretches of the pecs and the scalenes. And so, and to back up for a second, when we think about these three options, these three spaces for the thoracic outlet, so where is she getting her compression? Now, she has a first rib issue, but her compression is not between her first rib and her clavicle because her first rib doesn't go underneath her clavicle. Mm-hmm. She probably is getting some, and that's the other thing we didn't talk about yet, right, is because you could have multiple. Why couldn't somebody have tight scalenes, internally rotated shoulders, and then have their first rib approximate their clavicle and have some compression there?
Right. All of that could happen.
Tightened and shortened pec minor that then compresses that neurovascular bundle as it passes underneath the pec minor. I think it's pretty common for people to have some elements of this that maybe aren't even technically classified as neurogenic thoracic outlet syndrome, because we see their symptoms, like maybe I think a lot of our carpal tunnel patients have more of a multiple crush injury where maybe it is compressed by a shortened pec minor as well as carpal tunnel, as well as having some, you know, neck contribution to this too. So anyway, what's altered in Christy is her scalene. Because her first rib is anomalous, her scalene is hypertrophied on that side.
Oh, okay.
Now, jumping ahead a little bit, they sort of comment on that in some imaging later, but she ended up having to have a lot of imaging. So I'll talk about that in a minute. So I do some light stretching. I do some adjustments. I also did acupuncture. Now, I use acupuncture. For those that don't do acupuncture, don't hear that I do that and think that it's some sort of strange, ununderstandable thing. I use it like people use massage. I use it to loosen tight muscles. Mm-hmm. You could use ultrasound to do the same thing. You could use PNF stretching. You could use a massage tool, right? I just use it to relax muscle spasm. I don't use it to treat high blood pressure and ulcers and
right.
all kinds of stuff. I just use it for pain and spasm. So I find a muscle spasm and I put an acupuncture needle in the muscle spasm. It's as simple as that. So when you hear me say that I do acupuncture, it's basically just my version of working on the muscle.
Right. So when
it's just a modality.
When anybody else hears that, don't think that that's something you also need to do. That's
yeah.
It just happens to be the one more.
Yeah. I worked on the muscle. You could work on the muscle however you want.
Right.
And so she gets some improvement. She has less pain. She has better range of motion. But her arm, she still has pain, numbness and tingling in her hand. She gets some fatigue in her arm. It's not as often. It's not as severe, but it does affect her. And the other thing that as her pain goes down, you know, we all experience this, right? When somebody's lower back gets better, then they say, well, no, I got this shoulder blade thing. And, you know, 9.5 times out of 10, probably 10 times out of 10, you knew, if you think about it, that they had the shoulder thing, or well, even if you didn't, they had the shoulder thing before. It's just now that the lower back's not bothering them. Now it's more apparent to them. And so the thing that became more apparent to our patient here is that she became much more aware of are much more vocal about this clicking in her neck. So
just an audible click, not a painful click, just an audible click. It wasn't painful,
but it happened all the time with movement. And you know, the other thing that could happen is that she had protective muscle spasm, and so she didn't have as much range of motion.
Because she was better from treatments.
She was better from treatments, so the muscle relaxed, and she started to get this click. But then if she didn't do treatment, then she had more pain. So it was like trading one for the other.
Okay.
But she had this
click. But
again,
the click wasn't uncomfortable, nor was it painful. Nope. It was just audible.
It was just audible. And it bothered her a lot. And I know, thinking about the physiology of this, I'm thinking, okay, well, there's only so much that I can do because this rib is blocking normal function.
It's there. You're not going to be able to move it. It's there.
And she still has, and she's probably 50% better symptom wise. And so I, you know, before doing all we learn when we treat our patients, we learn what works, and sometimes we get an education on the medical system, and how things work there too with different conditions. But so I researched a surgeon who treats thoracic outlet syndrome. Mm-hmm. To refer her to, just to see what options that she had. Again, from my perspective, so it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what's important to me. It matters what's important to the patient. Mm-hmm. And even though a non-painful click doesn't seem like a big deal to me, and you know, a lot of improvement, 50% improvement in her hand and her arm was pretty good to me, she was not satisfied. She was very frustrated by this situation. She had some other stuff going on at home. Her longtime husband was starting to develop some dementia issues at a young age. And so it was just like another thing weighing on her. So
got it.
I wanted to,
you want to be respectful of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I researched this surgeon. It was just an internet research, you know, kind of a thing, yeah. But based on, you know, what this person's, you know, qualifications and interests and all these sorts of things were. So I referred her to her, and they did an ultrasound on the arm, and it was a normal ultrasound. And because the ultrasound was normal, the surgeon said, "I can't help you."
Huh.
Now, this is really frustrating for me and for the patient, because she and I both know that she has some issues here. Would you consider this? And I actually even called the surgeon's nurse and said, "Hey, could I talk to the surgeon? I think there's more here. Is there other testing we can do?" Totally ghosted. Never heard again.
That's too bad.
And so the patient's really frustrated because she's thinking, hey, there is something more here. And meanwhile, I still am adjusting her. I'm still working on her muscles. We're still getting some slow progress, but she still has the aching in her arm, the tingling in her fingers, and again, this click. And again, I'm trying to help her from, you know, my sort of shortened medium-term plan, and also trying to help develop a long-term plan, because again, how much, you know, biomechanical function can we expect when her movement is blocked?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a mechanical blockage. It's not. Yeah.
And even though it's only attached to T1, that still is going to restrict movement of the lower cervical spine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And with, you know, with shoulder movements as the rib changes and those kinds of things, it's going to affect her. So never heard. And so, you know, she's over the course of the next couple months, we back off on frequency a little bit, because I'm thinking, okay, do I really need to see her a lot if our expectations are sort of limited in the long run?
Mm-hmm.
She maintains pretty well, and I'm thinking, okay, I've got to get her some relief. So I referred her to a pain management clinic, and hopefully my thinking is, okay, so if a vascular surgeon is not going to do anything, and again, this person is a vascular surgeon that she was sent to, again, in hindsight, I guess I can't fault her because there wasn't a vascular issue. But again, 95% of these are neurogenic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there probably are lots of folks with this around, like our patient here that sort of gets stuck somewhere in the middle and maybe they don't see a chiropractor or even no chiropractor can help. So anyway, I think we can help with these in a lot of situations, just thoracic outlet syndrome in general. But so you've got this congenital SERBS anomaly in there. And so I send her to a pain management clinic to hopefully go on this facet joint degeneration, because maybe trying to combine pain management techniques and chiropractic treatments, maybe if they do something for the facet joints, maybe it's a facet joint injection, maybe it's a medial branch block, and she gets some pain relief in from the facet joints, maybe her neck loosens up and maybe there's, you know, the scalenes loosen up, maybe we can get her some improvement that way.
Right.
Again, I'm thinking that probably, you know, surgery for this rib thing is off the table because somebody said no.
Right.
Well, that and so she sees a pain management physician. They do a medial branch block, which is where they inject the medial branch of the spinal nerve, which goes to the facet joint.
Okay.
She gets relief for maybe a relief of the neck pain, no relief of the arm pain at all. And the relief of the neck pain was maybe like 2 or 3 days. And typically when they do that, a lot of times they will do lidocaine,
okay,
which is a medication that maybe lasts 2 or 3 hours in the body. And then what they will do is they'll follow up a week or 2 weeks later with injecting the same area with Marcaine, which lasts maybe closer to 8 or 9 hours in the body. So this is called a rhizotomy workup.
Okay.
And so if those two injections help, and then time-wise you can see that the first one helped and then the second one helped longer, then from a pain management perspective, the idea is then that the facet joint is a source of pain, and then they will put in a probe, a needle, and heat it up to something like 200 degrees Celsius, and they'll burn out the medial branch of the spinal nerve.
They have to pass, they have to do both of the short and the longer testing first. Yep. Okay.
They typically keep a pain diary, and most of these have to have insurance prior authorization, and those are requirements. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a huge fan of these. I'm just saying,
it just, that's what
this
it is.
Is what they chose to do. This is what the procedure is. She basically sort of failed after the first one and never proceeded with the second one because it wasn't helping her. And this is she's a very no-nonsense, very direct person, and she was just not going to do it.
Got it.
Which I didn't necessarily think she needed to do. I was just trying to help her some way.
Right.
Right. And so the lucky thing is that she just happens to get an appointment with, I think she just took the first available. And then I'm thinking about this. I never set this up. The pain clinic set this up.
Okay.
So this is an orthopedic surgeon. It's a spine surgeon. Because I don't necessarily think that she needed to consider spine surgical options. That just wasn't the kind of the nature of this.
Right.
So she gets on the schedule of a really well-known, really respected spine surgeon in the area. But he's basically within weeks of retirement. He's been a spine surgeon for probably, I don't even know, 40 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he takes an interest to this situation. You know, his ears perk up a little bit. He's got time. He doesn't have an entire load of patients.
Yeah.
He understands that there's a problem here. He understands that it's not a spine problem.
So this just happens to get the right guy.
He happens to get the right guy. And our patient here is a little bit feisty. And our patient brings her sister, who's even feistier. And so with these women are not going to leave without answers from this person.
Okay.
And I think they got really lucky by finding this about to retire spine surgeon, because he had the time to listen.
Uh-huh.
He was willing to listen. He sort of took a little bit of an interest here because you don't see these every day.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so he agreed sort of with, not with the treatment modalities that I was doing, but he agreed that this first rib and this thoracic outlet syndrome, that this was a problem that should be chased down, and that she probably would get some significant improvement if something was done about this first rib.
Okay.
Which both the patient and I were, and her sister, very, I was excited that finally something is going to be done.
Right.
And so now remember, when I'm going through all these things, there we talked about before, there's no definitive test that shows thoracic outlet syndrome, right?
Right.
And so, the, you know, he, this surgeon, orders an MRA of the brachial plexus.
Okay.
So magnetic resonance MRI angiogram.
Oh, okay. Kay? Got it. Yep.
So 95% neurogenic, less than 1% are arterial, but the first thing we do is an arterial test. Not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it was negative, and we know why.
Okay, got it.
The MRA was totally normal. So she had total, you know, normal function of these blood vessels. So they inject dye. They put her in the MRI machine, and it's normal. Over the course of a few months, she had lots of different testing. She had a thoracic CT. She had a chest CT. Now, so in the chest CT and the thoracic CT, both of those, you can actually see the CERB's anomaly. You can see the rib. And on both of those CTs, they talked about the scalene appearing to be hypertrophied, because they can get a little bit of soft tissue detail in the CT.
Okay.
She had a cervical MRI as in here too, even before I did it, before she even went to the pain clinic. But it's interesting, on the cervical MRI, they don't comment at all, because it's, you know, it ends at C7. So there was no evidence of this rib thing. And we didn't say this, but back 20 years before all this, she actually had another cervical MRI, which showed some degeneration and arthritis even 20 years ago, but nothing on the rib, because the rib attached to T1. So it was totally missed 20 years ago.
Oh, got it.
So she's undergoing all of these tests that are negative. They even did an MRI of her brachial plexus.
Oh, that's wild. She went through
all of these different tests.
Which, okay.
You know, if you think about it, they're all in the same area. You would think that there's some coverage there, some gray area. So credit to this surgeon for not giving up and believing this woman.
Right. I mean, that says a lot.
Looking for something to, and this is kind of, you know, we can test and do orthopedics and palpate and those kinds of things. Again, sidebar here real quick.
I love your sidebars.
We as chiropractors have so much knowledge about anatomy. And when you combine that with the all-day, everyday skill of feeling these tissues, knowing what you're feeling and feeling them, feeling hundreds, feeling thousands, feeling tens of thousands of different spines and different muscles, we have skills.
Absolutely.
And we have skills that are incomparable to other folks. Now, I'm not saying other professions don't have skills, but when I don't think you really can compare the skills between, let's say, the people that also treat pain, mm-hmm. Orthopedic surgeons and orthopedists in general, even if they don't do surgery, people that do injections. They, like, if you're doing a pain management injection, you might know anatomy, but they don't palpate. They don't have their hands feel the problem. Even orthopedists who do orthopedic tests don't have the same level of skill when it comes to palpation. And I think diagnosis, when you combine that skill and experience of knowing what healthy, normal tissue should feel like, combined with our knowledge of anatomy, I don't think there's any better physical diagnostician than chiropractors, period.
I would agree.
So anyway, soapbox.
I mean, yes, yeah, soapbox. But I mean, I think that's a very important point to make. I mean, don't sell yourself short.
Exactly. And so I knew that this patient had a problem. But again, the first person that this patient saw found nothing on a test. I feel like
it's a lot of times
they're in medicine, they can be, some providers are very reliant on their tests. If the labs are normal, then, you know, nothing's wrong.
And right.
We go through lots of examples of that. And anybody who does nutrition is, you know, fully aware of the limitations of, you know, the modern medical lab test. But credit to this person for not giving up and continuing to look in his own way to find help for her. And so he did set her up with another surgeon who did thoracic outlet syndrome surgeries. again, our nearly retired hero here is a spine surgeon. And so, you know, he didn't do, you know, rib resections and those kinds of things.
Got it.
So essentially he gets her set up with a surgeon who also agrees. Now this is not just, I'm going to write a referral for you. I'm going to hand it to the reception desk. They're going to send all your information over to this other clinic. This was him calling somebody else, getting their clinic, talking to the doctor personally, and saying, I have this person who needs help. I think it's, you know, this is what can be done. This is what should be done. And he really helped get the ball rolling. Even though the imaging was all negative, he didn't stop. And this, I think, would have not gotten as far if he didn't personally push it through. And so, essentially, she has the first rib removed surgically.
Okay. And how was she symptom-wise after that?
So, if you've ever known anybody that's had to have, like, cervical ribs removed, in this case, a first rib removed, it's a pretty aggressive surgery. The whole brachial plexus is there, the blood vessels there, so they had a vascular surgeon, they had a thoracic surgeon, and I think even another orthopedic surgeon. I think there were three surgeons in the room, two for sure, maybe three, just in case, you know, there
something,
was a
yeah,
lung puncture, that kind of thing, that everybody was there that could take care of whatever might happen.
So it's a very complex surgery.
Very complex because of the nerves and the blood vessels in the area. So she has it removed, and I don't see her for quite a while because she's recovering. And I probably see her about 4 months after the surgery. Uh-huh. And she has pretty limited range of motion in her shoulder, not because of the shoulder, but because of the scar tissue and pain
all
and the healing,
the
neck muscles.
There.
And they had to resect some of the anterior scalene. I think they do that to make room, but, you know, for that neurovascular bundle. So when you lift your arm, you know, there's a lot of muscles that participate. So, and she was, you know, she was getting better and she was doing some stretches and exercises. The click was gone.
Oh, good.
Her hand was fine, like no numbness, no tingling. The kind of deep, achy pain in her upper arm and sometimes moving to her forearm was gone. So essentially, the only pain she had was from surgery. So
okay.
She was very glad that she had it.
I was going to say, that sounds like a success for her.
Yeah, it was, for sure. Now, again, she's gradually transitioning. She's not in the area as much. She kind of has a cabin a little bit different place, and so her husband's there. And remember, I mentioned before that he has dementia, so he's spending a little more time there, so she's spending less time around, so I don't see her that often.
Okay.
When I'm able to, I still do our typical, you know, standard adjustments. I would love to see her more frequently, you know, a couple, two or three times a week for a month or two. I would love now to see what we could help her get in terms of her neck range of motion, because now there's not that physical block there.
Right.
Now we can, you know, could make some more progress from a soft tissue perspective, because all of that has changed as well. And I think we could help with that function now. I mean, can you imagine all those muscles, so you've got the clavicle and the scapula and all the scalenes. Now it's like a wedge has been removed, a block has been removed.
Right.
That was physically blocking movement. I would love to see what we can do there long term, but obviously it's the real world, and you know, patients have lives outside of what I would like to do for them. But she's really happy with the surgery. And even over the course, I did get to see her for maybe once every couple weeks. I've maybe seen her, you know, 3-4 times since the surgery, and even in that short period of time with her stretching and me working on it a little bit. She's pretty, like, timid about too much work on it.
Okay.
Just because she's scared. She doesn't want to, like, mess it up or anything.
It's finally feeling good for her.
It's finally feeling good. But some light stretching and her range of motion, you know, started at maybe 90 when I saw her at her shoulder and is probably, you know, close to 120. So her function's getting better.
Okay.
But the, you know, now she basically traded at times 8, 9 out of 10 deep gnawing, you know, pain for maybe more of a constant 3.
And that I'm sure for huge or for her is huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Serb's anomaly. It's one of those things that it's on the whole laundry list of anomalies and those kinds of things, but
not very common, but super interesting when you find it.
And especially in this situation when it was really causing pretty significant problems. And, you know, ideally I would love to be the person that helps them through and solves the problem and fixes them and not have to have surgery. But in a situation like this, I felt like they're really, it was a literal and figurative block, you know, structurally to achieving what, you know, the biomechanics that she needed. So
that is a very cool, you know, subject. I'm so glad that she got the improvement that she did.
Yep, me too. Yep. And so let me just summarize this here real quick. We talked a lot about a lot of different things, but clinically, the vast majority of what you're going to see is neurogenic. So nerve compression, neurogenic thoracic outlet syndrome. And as far as the evaluation portion of it, you probably aren't going to find a decrease in pulse with tests like Adson's or Wright's. Because again, that's arterial, which is less than 1% of thoracic outlet syndrome. So with it being neurogenic, we can use the upper limb test of LV, the upper limb tension test of LV, which is like a straight leg raise in terms of its nerve tension capabilities and testing sort of underlying philosophy. From a treatment perspective, chiropractic adjustments to the neck, the shoulder, the first rib, because oftentimes as the scalenes get short or tight over time or spasmed in the short term, they're going to elevate that first rib. So with the first rib elevated, it's going to be narrowing that costoclavicular space, causing the possibility of compression there. Adjusting the shoulder is going to reduce the muscle spasms around that shoulder girdle. In office, you can do a contract and relax stretching on the scalenes. The middle scalene is a straight lateral flexion stretch to the opposite side. The anterior scalene is turning the head toward the affected side while then laterally flexing away and stretching. And again, you can do a contract and relax type of thing just to speed it up. Because the muscle will relax faster than just a pure stretching on its own. You can stretch the pec minor, which is done with the, not at 90 degrees of shoulder abduction, but at approximately 135 degrees. So another 45 degree angle up from there, then with extension, so bringing the arm back. Then at home, you can teach them the home versions of a scalene stretch, which would be lateral flexion, ipsilateral rotation, and then contralateral lateral flexion for the anterior scalene, and then a doorway stretch for the pec minor, which would again be with that shoulder at about 135 degrees. And so the combination of stretching at home and then your adjustments can make a big difference with this. And in order to support proper posture as well, you can teach them a middle and lower trapezius facilitating exercise, which would be standing like a big T with your palms up and then squeezing the shoulder blades back and then bringing the points of the shoulder blades together and really squeezing the middle portion and the lower portion, the inferior angle of the scapula together at the bottom and holding that for ideally working on the ideally working on building endurance to that muscle, but holding for 10 seconds and doing that 3 times and doing that after the pec stretch. So in combination with the lengthening of the pec and then the turning back on of those middle and lower traps will ultimately help keep the scapula drawn backwards, which will long-term help keep the length in the pec minor. And so give those things a try in your office. And hopefully you also find that they get a good result for your patients. That's it for this hour with ChiroAudio.com. You can now take the quiz that goes along with this hour, and you can print the certificate anytime you'd like. And your next hour with us will be ready whenever you are.